would be quiet and the temperature would be mild, but Murphy's Law. It's our great pleasure to have with us this afternoon Professor Göran Ristad of the University of Lund, who is Sweden's leading historian. He's also one of Europe's half dozen best informed scholars on the United States. At the same time, he has not ignored his native land in his own historical research, especially 17th century Sweden, when Sweden, as we all know, was one of the major powers of Europe. Americans, however, know him best for many excellent and perceptive writings on the foreign relations of the United States. And among these writings are books and essays on American expansionism and its critics, particularly at the turn of the century, on Congress and foreign policy and affairs, on refugees, and especially with special relevance to our today's subject, his discussion of the concept of the Munich idea and its post-war embodiment in the idea of falling dominoes. He comes to the United States often to lecture and do research. This time, as we acknowledge with special gratitude, he comes as the guest of Professor Norman Graebner, himself no mean shakes as a lecturer. The occasion couldn't be more timely. What we have viewed as a danger throughout most of the post-war world, with perceived dominoes about to fall to the rival Soviet Union, has turned historically as one by one we have witnessed the fall of dominoes away from the Soviet Union. Professor Ristad this afternoon will speak on the nature, applicability, and validity of this concept, that events in world affairs tend to follow one another in some common or related sequence. It's a great pleasure to have one of Europe's most outstanding scholars with us today.
Thank you very much for your very kind introduction. It's a great pleasure, a great honor to be here. Of course, I always feel a little insecure speaking about American foreign policy in this company, but I hope you will forgive my doing that anyway, or trying to do that. In the fall issues, 1989, of scholarly journals with a focus on foreign policy and international relations, appeared, not surprisingly, numerous articles dealing with the sensational and revolutionary changes taking place in Eastern and Central Europe. The interpretations varied, of course, but most of them had one thing in common. They argued that whatever happened in Poland, in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, even in the Soviet Union, one thing would remain unchanged for years to come: the German Democratic Republic. There was no visible cracks in the Berlin Wall. Even if East Germans left in ever-increasing numbers, East Germany was a solid state, the communists so entrenched that the onslaught of reformist ideas could not be expected to take effect before, say, the mid-90s. Ironically enough, this point was made in articles that appeared even the week when the Berlin Wall came tumbling down. The fascinating changes that have been and still are taking place in Central and Eastern Europe are almost unbelievable. Eruptions and earthquakes are changing the political landscape beyond recognition. Time-honored truth are discovered to be myth. There's one aspect that is especially intriguing and also, I might add, somewhat disturbing, namely the fact that even to experts, to close watchers of the events unfolding behind what used to be called the Iron Curtain, surprises have followed surprises. Few, if any, have anticipated the scope of the development, and certainly not the speed with which the dominoes have been falling. Nobody seems actually to have understood the frailty of the totalitarian structures, their total lack not only of legitimacy, but also of staying power once the myth had been exposed. How can this failure to see what now, with the benefit of hindsight, seems rather obvious, be explained? Well, one answer is the extremely powerful effects of perceptual predispositions, of pre-existing images based on historical experiences and ever-repeated interpretations. To a generation that has lived through the Cold War, a certain worldview has been internalized, taken for granted, accepted as a self-evident truth. The Soviet Union and Eastern Europe has been seen as a more or less homogeneous sphere, dominated by a solid, centralized, bureaucratic, repressive structure, totally resistant to change. Well, my remark today will not, however, concern this Cold War syndrome, but instead a phenomenon which was instrumental in shaping and defining the worldview of, among others, American foreign policymakers in the Cold War era, what I call the Munich syndrome. Not very long ago, there appeared in a news magazine an article entitled Lessons of Munich. The article gave evidence to the fact that the Munich analogy is still alive and with us. The article contained a quotation from a speech by Jean Kirkpatrick, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Responding to critics of the American involvement in Nicaragua, Mrs. Kirkpatrick stated, quote, "It is not Vietnam that is the proper analogy, it is Munich." In my remark today, I shall discuss some aspects of the Munich analogy or the Munich syndrome in its various manifestations, how the analogy has been used and exploited, and maybe also try to point to the implications of the Munich syndrome for American foreign policymakers in the post-war or rather the Cold War era. The recurring swings in American foreign policy between isolationism and internationalism or interventionism, between extrovert and introvert periods, have been interpreted and explained in many different ways. One approach has been to see these swings as the outcome of an ongoing struggle between idealism or utopianism and realism, between ideals and self-interest. Even if the concepts and definitions vary, a common feature of these studies have been the identification of a clash between a realistic view of the world, of American national interest, and an adherence to a pragmatic foreign policy on the one hand, and on the other, a strong tendency to see the world through a filter of abstract ideals and moralistic principles. A strong inclination to interpret international politics as essentially a struggle of values. Well, like other countries, the United States has interests defined in terms of power, wealth, and security. But to borrow a formulation from Samuel Huntington, quote, "As a founded society, the United States also has distinctive political principles and values that define its national identity. In the views of many Americans, foreign policy goals should reflect not only the security and other interests of the nation, but also the political values and principles that define American identity. The problem has been to achieve a convergence between self-interest and morality. And this is to many the explanation for the recurrent tendencies in American history either to retreat to minimum relations with the rest of the world and thus avoid the problem of reconciling the pursuit of self-interest with the adherence to principle, or the opposite solution, to set forth on a crusade to bring the world into accordance with American principles, and in the process expand American powers. As Norman Graebner has pointed out in his thoughtful essay, An American Tradition in Foreign Affairs, for the founding fathers, competition and conflict were normal conditions of international life. The Union had to face an anarchical world with sovereign states each struggling to enhance its security, assure the integrity of its political life, and protect the well-being of its citizens through the exercise of power and diplomacy. To George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, the Adamses, and others, concepts such as the balance of power and equilibrium were important. To enter foreign crusades beyond the country's means and intentions would be, in their view, an unacceptable overcommitment. America should not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, but should pursue its real interests, nothing more. However, the exceptionalist tradition in the United States has been extremely important. American exceptionalism, a self-image permeated by a sense of uniqueness, is as old as the Union. The nation was founded as an antithesis to the old world, and the belief in the moral superiority of the United States was further enhanced and enforced by the immigrants, of whom many had left the old world in protest against existing social and political conditions, and regarded the United States as the promised land. Lacking a common ethnic or linguistic heritage, Americans have been inclined to construct a national identity out of beliefs in their own uniqueness. This American sense of separateness and superiority flourishes on both left and right of the political spectrum. It has been used in defense of crusading interventionism as well as of isolationism. Critics have seen this kind of American ideology as an extremely negative influence on American foreign policy making. For example, to Abdul Said, ideology, quote, has been the tragic element of American foreign policy making. By picturing ourselves as the enlightened saviors of all that is noble, we have been able to rationalize our world involvement, not in terms of the preservation of a dubious balance of power, but by seeing the United States as the champion of freedom against the nefarious force of communism, with the Soviet Union and China as its tangible manifestations. An interesting example of attempts to analyze the concept of American exceptionalism is Mona Harrington's book, The Dream of Deliverance in American Politics. A political myth is a set of mystic tenets of generally unexamined assumptions which determines the way a people or a society interprets its past and perceives present events and problems. The core of the complicated American political myth is, according to Mona Harrington, the myth of deliverance from evil, a myth with roots going back as far as the arrival of the first Puritan permanent settlers. A consequence of this myth had been, among other things, to turn American politics into a perpetual quest for the demon cause that is blocking the operation of just exchanges between all interests. And applying to the field of international relations, this means that through the prism of the myth of deliverance, conflict between nations do not appear as normal and not as caused by serious differences of interest, but as a result of evil abuses of power by fascists, communists, imperialists, multinational corporations, etc. 15 years ago, the Harvard sociologist Daniel Bell proclaimed the end of American exceptionalism. He argued that Americans no longer believed that their country was endowed with a uniquely moral role in world affairs. A loss of faith in the nation's future had turned the United States into a nation like all other nations. Obviously, this death sentence for exceptionalism was premature. The concept of American exceptionalism is complex, many-sided, and not very precise. However, it is not unimportant, and it's rather closely related to the theme of my remarks today. The use of history and the alleged lessons of the past, more specifically the Munich syndrome, the effects of perceptual predispositions on the interpretation of contemporary problems and thus on foreign policy making. The point has been made that important American historiographical traditions can be seen as a series of educational efforts for political purposes. Thus, the revisionists of the 1920s and 1930s, writing about the American intervention in World War I, advanced interpretations so influential that they became incorporated into the neutrality legislations of the 1930s. Well, World War II meant the death of isolationism and unilateralism and the temporary ascendancy of Wilsonian universalism among American diplomatic historians as well as foreign policy makers. They joined the politicians in an educational effort to prove that the refusal of the United States to join the League of Nations was responsible for World War II, and that the repetition could lead to a World War III. However, the Cold War soon led to a rapidly decreasing enthusiasm for the United Nations. Realists questioned the very concept of supranational organizations as a guarantee for security. Focusing on concepts such as national interest and balance of power, the realists attacked the legalistic and moralistic character of a traditional American foreign policy. Then in the 1950s appeared what John Higham in a well-known essay called The Cult of American Consensus. He contended that a striking change had taken place in American historiography. Emphasis was no longer on social strife, confrontation, and conflict in the American past, but on continuity, consensus, stability, and pragmatic moderation. However, the 1960s saw very little indeed of emphasis on consensus. Not least, the Vietnam War created an entirely new situation. Never before has the close connection between current events and interpretations of the past been so evident and so effectively demonstrated. The interrelationship between American historiography and political events has never been more striking. This might be an appropriate point of departure for a discussion of the way in which images of the past serve as perceptual predispositions, determining interpretations of contemporary problems and thus affecting policies and actions. The famous British historian, military historian, Little Hart, gave one of his many excellent books the title, Why Don't We Learn from History? He was not very optimistic about the lessons of the past, at least not if we expect history to provide what he called blueprints for progress. However, in his opinion, history could serve as a guiding signpost. To be sure, as such, it had its limitations, for although it could show us the right direction, it did not give detailed information about the road conditions. The value of history as a warning sign was more definite. History can show us what to avoid, even if it does not teach us what to do. By showing the most common mistakes that mankind is apt to make and to repeat. In his memoirs, The White House Years, Henry Kissinger emphasizes his own situation. with the background of two decades of the study of history when he became Nixon's advisor for national security. He tells us that, quote, "History is not, of course, a cookbook offering pre-tested recipes. It teaches by analogy, not by maxims. It can illuminate the consequences of actions in comparable situations, yet each generation must discover for itself what situations are in fact comparable." Kissinger and Little Heart are both skeptical of history as a cookbook or a blueprint. At the same time, they illustrate two different ways of looking at lessons of history. Kissinger points to the use of historical analogies in interpreting and explaining contemporary problems and future developments. Little Heart talks of history as a guiding signpost, but also current and former government officials and journalists. The conference was chaired by John K. Fairbank, and the list of participants was impressive. Even if the majority of those present did not think of themselves as historians, the papers and arguments presented were, in fact, exercises in history. Grappling with the problem of causes and possible future effects of the American intervention in Vietnam, they all delved into the past for possible answers. Of course, no consensus appeared. The participants addressed such questions as the functions and effects of images of the past on the perception and interpretation of contemporary situation and events, but they also dealt with the related and pertinent question of what lessons to draw from the Vietnam War. There was a common awareness of the fact that these lessons would depend on the interpretation of the American intervention in a historical perspective. In this debate, Samuel Huntington struck a defeatist note, quote, "If the legacy of misplaced analogies which the past has bequeathed on to the Vietnam debates is even half equaled by the misplaced analogies which Vietnam bequeathed to the future, terror will compound in a positively horrifying manner. It is conceivable that our policymakers may best meet future crises and dilemmas if they simply block out of their minds any recollection of this one. The right lesson, in short, may be an unlesson." Albert Wohlstetter had similar misgivings. "Of all the disasters of Vietnam," he said, "the worst may be the lessons that we'll draw from it." But Hans Morgenthau objected strongly, as did Stanley Hoffman, arguing, "Of all the disasters of Vietnam, the worst could be our unwillingness to learn enough from them." The controversy emanated from the very ambiguity and vagueness of the concept of lessons of history. Basically, all were agreed that thoughts leading to public policy were in essence historical. However, this did not answer questions concerning specific lessons of history. The revisionist assault of the middle and late 1960s was closely linked to the controversy over the American intervention in Vietnam. Thus, problems concerning inferences from the past and their effects on current foreign policy making was the subject of another conference on the Vietnam War, similar to the one sponsored by the Adlai Stevenson Institute. This conference took place in March 1967 at the Center for Research and Education in Estes Park, Colorado. The stated purpose was, quote, "to examine basic historical causes of overall United States posture in age of multi-revolution on all continents." This time, the participants were mostly revisionists of various kinds, among them William Appleman Williams and D.F. Fleming. And the papers were later published under the name, the title, "Struggle Against History, U.S. Foreign Policy in an Age of Revolution." In summing up the purpose of the volume, the editor contended that in the necessary quest for more adequate perspectives, no factor was more essential than history. The same point was made in other revisionist efforts, for example, in a book by Edmund Stillman and William Pfaff in their book Power and Impotence, where they claimed that the real danger to America was not the Soviets or Chinese communism or nuclear weapons, but the fact that American society was mired in illusions about the world, illusions rooted in history. Similar points were made in another book, Barton Bernstein's Towards a New Past. Well, then, what did images of the past mean for American foreign policymakers? For their perception and interpretation of contemporary situations and events. Because there will always be a discrepancy between reality and image, a discrepancy resulting from limits and impediments to the flow of information. But more important, I believe, is the discrepancy resulting from distortion of reality by perceptual predispositions, by pre-existing images of the past. This is, of course, is a rational process because information is often ambiguous. Evidence lends itself to multiple interpretations. Interpretation in any given situation must be guided by previous experiences. Without recall from memory, persons would no longer steer but drift, as Carl Deutsch put it. On the other hand, there is always the problem of cognitive distortion, that is the tendency to see what you expect to see, and to forget, reject, or distort information to make it fit existing ideas. Now, experiences of the 1930s had far-reaching and lasting effects on American foreign policymakers. At that time, isolationism was running strong, and it took the outbreak of World War II to weaken detachment and isolationism among large segments of the population. And it took Pearl Harbor to kill it completely. The shock of World War II, interpreted as the ultimate failure of appeasement, established a fixed image of the totalitarian states and of the democracies in the international arena during the 1930s. This image would prove to be immensely important for the makers of American foreign policy in the post-war era. And during the following years, it was to determine information, which information and which signals would be accepted or rejected, and how new situations would be interpreted. The central point and common denominator of these assumptions about the world was the inherent and unlimited expansionist aggressiveness of totalitarian states and the deadly danger of appeasement. This is what I call the Munich syndrome. It would be immensely influential in the making of American foreign policy process in the post-war era. These beliefs about the realities of international relations were expressed in different ways, but the message eventually was the same. And let me make it perfectly clear that we intend to commit none of the fatal errors of appeasement. These words were uttered by Franklin Roosevelt in his last campaign speech of the presidential election of 1940. In his acceptance speech in July, he expressed the hope that should the government next January pass into other hands, untried hands, inexperienced hands, as he said, they would not choose appeasement and compromise with those who seek to destroy all democracies everywhere. And a year later, after Pearl Harbor, the president told the American people, in the last few years, and most violently in the past few days, we have learned a terrible lesson. It is our obligation to our dead, it is our sacred obligation to their children and to our children, that we must never forget what we have learned. In his fireside chat on Christmas Eve 1943, Roosevelt told his audience, quote, "For too many years we lived on pious hopes that aggressor and warlike nations would learn and understand and carry out the doctrine of purely voluntary peace. The well-intended but ill-fated experiments of former years did not work. It is my hope that we will not try them again." No, that is putting it too weakly. It is my intention to do all that I humanly can as President and Commander-in-Chief to see to it that these tragic mistakes shall not be made again. However, the Cold War soon led to a dampening of enthusiasm for Wilsonian universalism and for the United Nations, and consequently to a weakening of the belief that American membership in and support of the League of Nations would have prevented the development that led to the Second World War. Foreign policy practitioners converted to the idea of limited alliances for security, such as NATO. In his address at the closing of the United Nations on June 26, 1945, President Truman maintained, quote, "If we had had this charter a few years ago, and above all, the will to use it, millions now dead would be alive. If we should falter in the future in our will to use it, millions now living would surely die." Less than 4 years later, he stated, quote, "It is a single document, but if it had existed in 1914 and 1939, supported by the nations who are represented here today, I believe it would have prevented acts of aggression which led to two world wars. The occasion now was the signing of the NATO Treaty on April the 4th, 1949. It was no longer the United Nations Charter President Truman was referring to. The United Nations had been replaced by NATO, Wilsonian universalism by a quest for a balance of power. However, the rhetoric remained more or less the same. The policy of containment after World War II may in some respects be considered as a program based on assumptions that constitute the Munich Syndrome, assumptions about the problem realities, intentions of the actors, attainable goals, effectiveness or means. And early apparent successes such as Iran, Turkey, Greece served to reinforce these assumptions and the perceptual predispositions that followed from them. In announcing the decision to intervene in Korea, President Truman stated the case. "We will not engage in appeasement. The world learned from Munich that security cannot be bought by appeasement." And in his memoirs, he tells about his reaction to the news of the North Korean attack. He said, "In my generation, this was not the first occasion when the strong had attacked the weak. I recall some early instances, Manchuria, Ethiopia, Austria. I remembered how each time that the democracies had failed to act, it had encouraged the aggressors to keep going ahead. Communism was acting in Korea just as Hitler, Mussolini, and the Japanese had acted 10, 15, and 20 years earlier. And if this was allowed to go on unchallenged, it would mean a third world war, just as similar incidents had brought on the Second World War." When Dwight Eisenhower accepted the Republican nomination for president, one of the points where he attacked the Democrats with the greatest intensity was the Korean War. Not that the Republicans had any quarrel with Truman's actual decision to intervene, on the contrary. The big failure of the Truman administration was letting the Korean happen in the first place and then mismanaging the war. Said Eisenhower, "There is a Korean War and we are fighting it for the simplest of reasons, because free leadership failed to check and to turn back communist ambition before it savagely attacked us. There is no other reason than this: we failed to read and outwit the totalitarian mind. And then followed the message. World War II should have taught us all one lesson. The lesson is this: to vacillate, to hesitate, to appease even by merely betraying unsteady purpose, is to feed a dictator's appetite for conquest and to invite war itself. Also in the case of Kennedy, the effects of the Munich syndrome are clearly prominent. As a young man, Kennedy toured Europe. It was during the days just before the Second World War, returning to Harvard to write his honors thesis, Appeasement at Munich, soon to be published under the title Why England Slept, and widely read. In his book, Kennedy strongly condemned England for allowing Hitler first to rearm and then to outmaneuver the democracies at Munich. Kennedy frequently repeated these ideas, generally following the lines I think is typical of the Munich syndrome, thus his declaration on the question of Berlin in 1960. Quote, if we took the view with which some Englishmen took, that Prague or Sudetendeutsch were not worth a war in 1938, if we took that view about Berlin, my judgment is that the West Berliners would pass into communist orbit, and our position in West Germany and our relations with West Germany would receive a fatal blow. They are fighting for New York and Paris when they are struggling over Berlin. Therefore, the United States has to make it clear that they would fight. And in his radio television address in October 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy used the formula repeated by practically every American foreign policymaker after World War II, at least up to the late 1960s. Quote, the 1930s taught us a clear lesson. Aggressive conduct, if allowed to go unchecked and unchallenged, ultimately leads to war. The Munich syndrome played an important role in bringing about the disastrous Vietnam intervention. It is difficult to reach any other conclusion. The rigidity, the inability to re-evaluate the situation and to change policies, these were effects of a failure to grasp realities, a failure caused by powerful perceptual predispositions. In 1965, Lyndon B. Johnson again and again defended his administration's Vietnam policy with the same arguments. In a speech called Pattern for Peace in Southeast Asia, he insisted, the central lesson of our time is that the appetite of the aggressor is never satisfied. To withdraw from one battlefield means only to prepare for the next. On another occasion, he stated that defeat in Vietnam, quote, would encourage and spur on those who seek to conquer all free nations within their reach. This is the clearest lesson of our time. From Munich until today, we have learned that to yield to aggression brings only greater threats. And again, with a slight variation, surrender in Vietnam would not bring peace because we learned from Hitler at Munich that success only feeds the appetite of aggression. The Munich syndrome dominated the thinking also of, for example, Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State. He varied his message to some extent, but his address at a meeting of the U.S. Council of the International Chamber of Commerce in March 1965 is fairly typical. Quote, so what is our stake? What is our commitment in that situation? Can those of us in this room forget the lesson that we had on this issue of war and peace when it was only 10 years from the seizure of Manchuria to Pearl Harbor, about 2 years from the seizure of Czechoslovakia to the outbreak of World War II in Western Europe? Don't you remember the hopes expressed in those days that perhaps the aggressor would be satisfied by his next bite, and perhaps he will be quiet. Remember that. We learn that by postponing the issue, we made the result more terrible, the Holocaust more dreadful. We cannot forget this experience. And on another occasion, he exhorted his audience. Once again, we hear expressed the views which cost the men of my generation a terrible price in World War II. We are told that Southeast Asia is too far away, but so were Manchuria and Ethiopia. And George Ball, Under Secretary of State, contended, in the 1930s, Manchuria seemed a long way away. Ethiopia seemed a long way away. The rearmament of the Rhineland was regarded as regrettable, but not worth a shooting war. Year after that came Austria, and after Austria, Czechoslovakia, and then Poland, and then the Second World War. The central issue we face in South Vietnam is whether a small state on the periphery of communist power should be permitted to maintain its freedom. And that is an issue of vital importance to small states everywhere. The set of basic assumptions that constitute what I call the Munich Syndrome were reinforced by events that were perceived as successes. Strong pressure was exerted on the Russians to make them withdraw their forces from Iran in 1946. Aid was given to Greece and Turkey in 1947, and the success of these actions was seen as verification of the basic assumption of the Munich paradigm. A firm policy of non-appeasement was not only a necessity, but also paid off. Lyndon Johnson, more than perhaps any other president in the post-war era, seems in all his foreign policy analysis and actions to have been confined by the basic assumptions of the Munich paradigm. No one recites precedents so frequently, and typical for him is also his way of presenting a whole series of events as verifications of his interpretation of the foreign policy issue at hand. They served as reinforcing agents of his assumptive world, with roots in World War II and its prehistory. This is, for example, the case in connection with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. In a speech in New York City on August 3, 1964, President Johnson told his audience, "The challenge that we face in Southeast Asia today is the same challenge that we have faced with courage and that we have met with strength in Greece and Turkey, in Berlin and Korea, in Lebanon and in Cuba. And to anyone who may be tempted to support or to widen the present aggression, I say this: there is no threat to any peaceful power from the United States of America, but there can be no peace by aggression and no immunity from reply. That is what is meant by the actions that we took yesterday." He's referring to the reprisal bombings after the Tonkin Gulf incident. 2 months later, when discussing the incident, President Johnson added another example. He said, "President Truman met communist aggression in Greece and Turkey. President Kennedy met communist aggression in Cuba. And when our destroyers were attacked, we met communist aggression in the waters around Vietnam." While Iran, Greece, and Berlin served as reinforcing agents, as evidence of successful policies, the case of China was not taken as countering prevailing assumptions. Rather, it was by the Cold Warriors placed in line with the events of the 30s, demonstrating the danger to the free world of any weakening of an uncompromising, firm, no-appeasement position. Typical was the reasoning by Senator Thomas J. Dodd, Democratic Senator from Connecticut. Talking about the situation in Cuba in 1960, he made this point: "We should have learned from China, but we did not. 10 years after the communists seized power in China, we fell for precisely the same game in Cuba." He expressed unrestrained militancy at the time of the Berlin crisis in 1959, also on this occasion using China as a lesson with respect to almost every nation that has fallen victim to communist aggression. There was one point in time, one occasion, when a courageous and vigorous free world policy based on the unselfish application of moral principles could have frustrated communist aggression. That point in time was for the Ukraine 40 years ago, for Poland it was 13 years ago, for China it was 5 years ago, for Germany it is today. This may be our last chance to redeem our past errors, said Senator Dodd. Well, the focal proposition of the Munich Syndrome was to avoid the disastrous mistakes of the 1930s. Of course, the great danger is to learn too much, to overgeneralize. Thus, Robert Jervis has suggested a reformulation of Santayana's famous maxim, those who remember the past are condemned to make the opposite mistakes. In many cases, too little attention is paid to the essential questions whether the failure really was a consequence of the policy pursued, and whether an alternative policy would have worked better. Also, how substantial the resemblance was between the new situation and the former one. The minds of men are cluttered with ideas and illusions about the past, wrote William Fulbright, contending that history, or at any rate, the interpretation that men place upon it, tends as much to obscure as to clarify the future. I believe that is far too pessimistic. The relationship between history and foreign policy is a matter of interaction. The present does not exist independent of the past. And if we modify our view of the past, we also alter our perceptual predispositions, our way of perceiving the present and defining its problems. But at the same time, new experiences give us new insights into the past. Historical revisionism, after all, the reconsideration and reappraisal of our view of the past is generally a response to a new situation. It then becomes in turn a factor in the process of change. And thus I am positive that the dramatic and monumental events that are taking place in Eastern and Central Europe will lead to a re-examination of past polities and established beliefs. Some revisionists have outspoken presentist concerns and frequently complain about the adverse effects of misperceptions caused by myth and false images of the past. At the same time, most historians emphasize the necessity of learning from history how limited human foresight is, even in the best of men and under optimal circumstances. What we know our experiences in Europe is a renewed realization of the fact that history is indispensable in any effort to understand the present and also is the only key we have to the future. Too many, the events taking place in Eastern and Central Europe today may seem enigmatic and mysterious, maybe less so if we apply a historical perspective. However, the lessons of history are never self-evident and must never be allowed to lead to dogmatic certitude. History does not provide blueprints or recipes. But what we can hope for is not clairvoyance, but insight. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Huckel, you've suffered in behalf of all of us. If you want to open the window, I will. I think they've stopped. Who would like to begin the discussion? You, Norman, do you want to?
Well, I was wondering, I could pose this question. The Munich Syndrome, as you suggest, does play a very powerful role in American foreign policy. It's an easy way to rationalize a tough response, that if you don't make the response, why, what's going to happen is going to be far worse rather than better. So the longer you put it off, the worse it gets. And the supposition was, I guess, that there was an easy answer at Munich, that there World War II could have been stopped with just a frown properly placed. And we know that's not true, but the alternative at Munich was either to give away the Sudetenland or have war. We know that. So there was no easy answer there. And it begins with a misinterpretation of Munich. Now the question I ask is this: do you think that this tendency is uniquely American, or do you see it in other countries as well, in their rationalizations of behavior?
Well, I think that's common everywhere. It's not as important in countries like Sweden, because the impact of Sweden in the world is marginal. It's more important in American foreign policy. But I think the phenomenon is recognizable and existent everywhere. In Sweden, I would talk about the neutrality syndrome, because neutrality in Sweden is had achieved a status that nobody even discusses it or analyzes it. It's taken for granted. It's internalized. Nobody ever even questioned whether it's possible or not. It's above every kind of discussion. I think you could make it the case for Sweden as being dominated by neutrality syndrome, and you find corresponding phenomena in other countries as well. I think the Munich syndrome is so interesting because you have always to distinguish between rhetoric and substance. And it's not easy, it's difficult many times. And one question, of course, I would like to ask for anybody of you: did they mean what they said, or did they use this as a rhetorical figure for to mobilize support for a certain policy, or did they believe? I mean, the arguments made during the 60s especially that the intervention in Vietnam was nothing but stopping the Third World War from happening, with using and believing that it was a parallel to the Munich policies. It's hard to believe that they believed it. On the other hand, I think that they did. Some of them did, and I think it had a powerful impact in their way of perceiving the problem.
I knew four or five of the 15, 16 people that were in the room at Blair House the night the decision was made, and they all give the same account. And the account is that every man in the room, and people like George Kennan were not in the room, but every man invited to that meeting was guided by a common philosophy, and that was that if you didn't stop aggression at the source, why, it would fester, would expand, it would grow, and finally World War III would be necessary. So I think a lot of them certainly believed it. What becomes much more complicated to determine is how did they relate it to other things. For instance, most of the commentary on the insufficiency of Munich bears on this question of the relationship between communism and nationalism. In Eastern Europe, nationalism was held down by communism, and in particular the Red Army. And the moment the power of the Red Army dissipated, then nationalism exploded, as it exploded 20 years earlier in Africa and other parts of the world in different forms. But in Asia, exactly the opposite was true. Communism and nationalism merged in Vietnam and other places. And failure to take that into account had something to do with the difficult problems that ensued. I don't know whether historians would, wherever they come out on the right or wrong of Vietnam, would think that the interrelationship of these concepts is in a way even more important than an individual concept alone.
Yes, I think so. I think your point about Eastern Europe is very valid and very important. And I also think that you could develop the idea of the syndrome also in that context, because even close watchers of development in Eastern Europe and commentators took coherence of Eastern Europe for granted, more or less. There was so little opening, so little chance of any thing of what we have seen happening. People didn't believe it. And I've spoke to many people, even experts, some very good people, and they have published articles, and they are very red in their faces now because they didn't realize what was going to happen. For example, a very good book was published some time ago, it's 3 years ago, about the relationship between the Soviet Union and the Eastern European states. And he took Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary as examples. And I asked him, why did you leave out East Germany? Well, East Germany was atypical. That was not interesting because nothing would happen there. And that is the view taken as late. I read an article or two in Foreign Policy, I think, was the fall issue, discussing in terms, they will go slowly and nothing will happen in the next few years. We would have to wait for that. And I think that to some extent could be because we have been raised and get used to a bipolar world originally. And even if we didn't believe in a monolith communist world after 1959 or so, I think still these ideas have determined or blocked off perceptive analysis of Eastern Europe.
Other questions?
Do you think that the Western analysis, or let's say American analysis of these things was false?
I think they were not more false than European ones, because I think that there was about the same lack of insight or understanding of the frailty of the structures. And the amazing thing that happened as soon as the Brezhnev Doctrine was abandoned by Moscow, as soon as there was no danger of communist intervention. I mean, there was no way in which these governments that all lacked legitimacy, that is the main point, they were not legitimate. Their only source of power was backup from the Soviet Union. Remove that and they didn't have a chance to stand. And I think that is the key.
And that was inherently unpredictable, I think, because it depended so much on the worldview, let's say, of one man or a small coterie, that it's just inherently unpredictable.
Yes, but I think that some people had ideas about what was happening because they knew, for example, there is one economist, Åslund, who's written a book about Gorbachev's economy, and he predicted 3 years ago that the Soviet economy was absolutely going down the drain. It was irreversible, that there had to be drastic changes, even political changes, but even he could not imagine what is happening now, the totally disintegration of the Soviet Empire that seems to be coming.
Victor Yonke.
Professor Reinstadt, if we could take a second look at the Munich Agreement, which in a sense I think is an overly simplistic. I think the Munich Agreement was the culmination of a number of things. The Japanese invasion of Manchuria, the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, Auschwitz, the occupation of the Rhine and so on. President Roosevelt's Chicago Quarantine speech in 1937 was totally ignored, really, in the Quarantine indicator. So it almost made Munich inevitable.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the Munich Agreement. I don't think there was much of a I don't agree with the very harsh criticism of appeasement. I think that's to some extent based on hindsight. I mean, the options available to the democratic statesman was not that large. No, I think that I'm not discussing the Munich Agreement, but the use of the Munich analogy after 1945, which I think is false and exaggerated and oversimplified, and applied in cases where it did not should not apply.
Howard Cromwell.
We hear a lot in the papers lately about unification of East and West Germany, and there have been two options mentioned. One is that the new Germany, United Germany, be a part of NATO. The other option, it be independent. But could there be a third option? That the European community be expanded to include Poland and Romania, even Russia? And would that tend to be an antidote to what you talked about, the Munich?
Well, of course, the reunification issue is being discussed, and there have been so many different interpretations of the possibilities and possible outcomes. I think you're right. I think what people are looking for is a solution with a larger European context where you sort of accept a reunification, because I don't think there's any way around that. That would come anyway. So the point is to make it happen in a way that would satisfy Polish interests, and also would prevent Germany into developing a too dominant role in Central Europe. It will be dominant anyway. I mean, there is enormous potential economically. But if this is done within a European context, and that would maybe take care of the immediate danger of political dominance, that's what people are looking for, of course. But I think there will be enormous problems, not only political problems, but economic problems in this kind of integration. There's been other ideas of confederation where the various East German state lender within the East Germany should join individually in this confederation. I think I wouldn't like to predict, because I would be proven wrong very soon, probably.
Jack Armitage.
As an authority from long historical experience in Sweden with neutrality, how would you assess the potential viability of neutral status for the Glossy states, the East European states?
Well, I think that neutrality is a thing that might be not valid anymore. I mean, the development in Europe, at least, is so fast now that Sweden being neutral, that is a technical term which will not mean very much in a situation where our economy will be under any circumstances integrated into the European community. And if we are moving towards a supranational entity like the European market, but also other kinds of European organizations, I don't think that neutrality would mean very much.
Isn't it important in this discussion to separate the European community, meaning the economic aspect, and the NATO alliance, meaning the security aspect? I mean, Sweden could be a total member of the EC, and still, I would guess, they might hesitate to join NATO if NATO continued to exist.
Well, they wouldn't join NATO. That's that issue was taken care of in 1948. That's not possible. On the other hand, I'm sure, I'm not an expert on NATO, but I'm sure that NATO will change character drastically in the near future. So will, of course, the Warsaw Pact. And that is one of the many intriguing but difficult issue, what will happen once we don't have NATO and not the Warsaw Pact, because they, whatever they were sort of guarantee for stability. You knew what they stood for and how they worked.
This is what, partly why I was asking the question about neutral East Europe. It's easily conceivable that the Soviets are not going to raise any great to-do if the East European states proceed to have a rather vigorous association with the European community, the economic aspect of it. My guess is the Soviet Union would not look so tranquilly on the prospect of Poland, Yugoslavia, Hungary, and what have you, joining a security alliance.
That wouldn't be in the interest of the West either. I mean, we don't want to put a sort of dividing line close to the Soviet border. It's not in the interest of anybody at all to have Poland join NATO, for example. The issue at present, of course, is what to do with the unified Germany. Should that be a member of NATO? Should it be neutralized? Should you try this very, I think, impossible situation where the western part of the reunified Germany should be part of NATO, but eastern Germany should be in a demilitarized zone, which is one of the ideas that has been put forward. I don't believe that's possible. But I don't know much about that.
But as an historian, has there ever been a case in which a country with the kind of power and potentially increased power that Germany has now and is certainly going to have in Europe, fulfilling a neutral role? I mean, it's almost incompatible with the concept of power to assume it having a neutral role. Its influence just can't be encapsulated in anything that we describe as neutrality, can it?
No, I don't think it would be neutral in the legal sense. That is an impossibility. But I think that maybe we'll reach a stage where neutrality is no longer a very interesting concept, because the ties between European countries would be so involved, so integrated, that neutrality is not a valid option anymore. But I'm sure that Germany, whatever solution we choose now, that's no guarantee for the future. I mean, sooner or later, Germany will be dominant on the continent. I'm sure about that. Economically dominant, and economy and politics are closely united, of course. But doesn't mean that Germany will be an aggressive sort of state. It doesn't mean necessarily that they would demand to get back the eastern part of the German territories, because even that could be passé. I mean, that's the type of issues that maybe not will be interesting in the future.
Al Fernbach, Bill Wemple, and then we probably better adjourn.
I wonder whether, in considering the Vietnam situation, one hasn't got to note that there were objective facts which were not cranked into the picture very well. I think that Ken has mentioned one especially, but there were others. We were, as a country, very ignorant of the conditions on the ground at the time. We were making, as you say, a perceptual judgment about the situation in terms of global outlook rather than what we would have run into in the actual situation. But also, we got involved, and then the name of the game changed to some extent with the Cultural Revolution and other factors of that sort. And we were kind of caught in a muddy situation. Had that not been so, had Johnson been able to put off with 1,000 or 2,000 casualties at the most, what would have happened to the whole thesis of dominoes?
Well, I'm not sure that I quite understood your question. You mean if he could have achieved his goal by a few thousand casualties?
If he had had a better calculation as to the conditions on the ground than he had, because we had only half a dozen people who knew anything about Vietnam, and
yeah,
they were not very much listened to.
Well, I can't see how that could have been done. I mean, the problem, I think the problem was entirely different than how it was perceived in Washington. And I couldn't see any way where you could solve it with a few thousand casualties and get away and have achieved your goal.
Well, let me put it in another context then. Your problem of perception as against reality affects also collective security.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the Munich syndrome had something to do with the idea that collective security ought to substitute. Mm-hmm. And yet, very early on, well before Vietnam, we began to realize in the UN that it wasn't going to be collective. And what I'm getting at, in other words, is that it didn't just simply be historical perception, but you need to know your facts on the ground.
Bill Winslow.
Do you think that you're facing a novel situation in which the consideration of the Munich syndrome and the like is receding into the background, at least for an indefinite time, while we witness the extraordinary imminent breakup of the Soviet Union after 70 years into a secession of this and that satellite and even their own internal peoples wanting to break loose and become independent nations. I don't know, is there any real historical precedent for us to think about in confronting that kind of situation?
Can we couple Norman's with that,
Not on the same subject.
All right, then, please.
Well, that's a very tough question. I think we have an entirely new configuration. I think it's hard to apply old rules to that. When it comes to the breakdown of the Soviet Empire, because there are lots of precedents to that. Maybe not exactly, because if you look close to any kind of analogies, you'll find that there are also many dissimilarities. But what surprises people so much is that we have learned, and I remember reading books and learning at school, that one thing the Soviet Union had really succeeded was to create a sort of national structure where different ethnic groups lived together and seemed to work together within this body politic. And now we find that that is not true. They are back to square one. It seems to me that that sort of balkanization of the whole Soviet Union, where the ethnic groups and new nationalities have exactly the same intentions, emotions, and ambitions as always. And because it also means a destabilization, and it's hard today to know what kind of problem that will emerge from that, but at least we knew what the Soviet Union stood for, and with a long experience now, how to deal with the Soviet Union. We don't know what will emerge from this new situation with national confrontation and conflicts between Hungary, Romania, between
Azerbaijan, Armenia, between Iran and the Soviet Union, and so on. This is an entirely new situation. I think it's very difficult to predict what will happen.
The last question, definitely, Norman.
We speak so glibly now of a united Germany becoming the dominant force of Europe, and we seem to accept this as a reality and don't even object to it. But I'm reminded of the fact that in 1870, Germany became the dominant nation of Europe, and that was not acceptable. And you finally had a triple entente that was designed to see to it that Germany would not become a dominant power in Europe. And when in the late 1930s, Germany again moved towards becoming the dominant power, again the British, the French, and others said, this is not tolerable. We would rather fight than accept this. Now, do we have a new view toward Germany now? Or what is the role of Germany? What are the limits on what Germany will be permitted as the dominant power of Europe?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. And also, I remember reading A.G.P. Taylor, who is a very perceptive historian, of course. He made the point that if Germany had been able to avoid the war in 1914, they would automatically be totally dominant on the continent. It was stopped by Versailles and the First World War. And then they came back and they were on their way to become again the most dominant power. Then came the Second World War. And then he said, luckily, Germany was divided. It was not planned that way, as we know. It happened that way. And he said that was a good thing for Europe that it happened. And now we are on our way to a new situation where this dividing line between East and West Germany will disappear. On the other hand, it's very hard to find acceptable basis for stopping it. I mean, you can't intervene in a democratic country like West Germany, one of your allies, and a country that now has a history of at least 30, 40 years of a totally democratic government. You can intervene to stop them and East Germany from doing a voluntary unification. I mean, what do you kind of argument? You can say, well, we're all for integration in a larger context, but not you and not you. It's like going back to 1919 when the peace treaty of Versailles stopped Austria from joining Germany. Because that was for the same reason that Austria joining Germany, which the Austrian wanted to, was unacceptable because that would increase Germany's strength. But today you don't have the same situation. Germany is on good terms with the former victors, and there is no power in sight that really can stop Germany from being reunited. Of course, theoretically, Gorbachev could, but I don't think he's going to. Margaret Thatcher would like to, but I don't think she has the means to do it.
I know all of you would like to go on asking question after question, and that's the finest tribute one can pay to a scholar who has written a paper. I think you're all to be congratulated by your intelligent and informed perception of the very well-documented and scholarly presentation that you've listened to. But most of all, the speaker is certainly deserving of our praise for taking very seriously the opportunity to help us understand this terribly difficult and complicated issue. So we thank you very much. Thank you.